If you've basically told the financial markets that you're not going to raise interest rates, you're not going to raise your policy rate again, then the only question is, you know, the only direction you're going to go is down.
Yeah.
And the question is when you're going to do it
yeah.
and how long and how quickly you're going to do it. So the bets are on that. So there's a lot of, as we say, dry powder out there waiting to come in. When it becomes clear that somebody's ready to go, then there will be a lot of money put into the next bet.
Which could also be problematic.
Which could be problematic and adds to volatility.
Okay, I'd like to ask people to introduce themselves. Maybe just a short introduction, who you are and what you do.
Okay. My name is Catherine Mann. I'm an external member at the Monetary Policy Committee at the Bank of England. I also have academic affiliations with Brandeis University in the United States and Alliance Manchester Business School in the UK.
So central banks share a lot in common when it comes to how they operate, but the Bank of England is the only one to have four external voting members on its board.
And the reason why this particular structure was set up when the Bank of England gained its independence was to have views and eyes that came from a broader range of backgrounds. And so the external members have expertise in productivity growth, have expertise in my case, being an international economist coming from the United States as opposed to being from the UK, and other sort of areas of expertise. This is, it's unique. I mean, no other central bank has this degree of external participation in the monetary policy making process.
Catherine Mann was invited to take part in a discussion at the IMF on the long-term challenges of capital flows in a world of tighter monetary policies and increasing fragmentation. I met up with her after the panel. So this discussion today on capital flows was on a global scale, but a lot of your world, at least these days, has to do with what goes on in the UK. So how has the UK fared through this period of high inflation?
So the UK economy has been characterized by two features over the last, say, year and a half, this period of time when the economy emerged from the COVID crisis and then was hit by the second crisis associated with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That, of course, has precipitated a very significant increase in inflation, which we are now in the position of unwinding. The consequences of a high inflation environment, as well as interest rate increases, burdens part of the population in terms of expenditures. And there was a bit of a technical, well, we call it a technical recession in the latter half of 2023. It was a very, very shallow recession, but it was importantly, if we looked at market sector output as opposed to GDP as a whole, there was weaker market sector output than, in fact, I had expected. Now, usually, you would expect weak market sector output to be associated with a deceleration in prices of the things that people are spending money on, you know, services in particular. And this is a bit of the concern that we have that I have as a central banker, is that despite the deceleration in demand and output, we have yet to see a deceleration in services prices. Yes, headline inflation has come down because energy prices have come down so much. But services, which are a very large share of the consumer basket, have seemed to be very resilient in the face of slower and slower demand. So that's a bit of a puzzle, and that's a bit of a challenge.
And so you were asked today to talk about capital flows. And so how has it worked for the UK in terms of trying to attract investors or at least not lose the ones that you already have?
I think the best way to think about the challenge of capital flows for the UK economy, it's a small open economy, is that what happens in other countries, particularly our neighbors, meaning the United States on one side and Europe on the other, and what the central banks in those two economy and regions choose to do as appropriate for their economy, those have very significant impacts for an economy like the UK. Mm-hmm. And let me give you some specific examples of how it affects a monetary policy decision maker. So you know that the Bank of England is very transparent. Mm-hmm. Our votes are recorded when the monetary policy decision is announced. So you know exactly how I voted. And I tend to tell people why I voted in mm-hmm. speeches around that time. So in February, one of the reasons why I voted to increase bank rate by 25 basis points at that meeting was because financial markets had been very eager to, on the expectation of numerous cuts in the United States, in the UK, in Europe, and that expectation of many cuts over the course of the 2024, in my view, had loosened financial conditions beyond what was appropriate given the situation that we were in with regard to sticky prices.
Yeah.
Now, I then move to the next policy meeting where I chose, I thought the appropriate policy stance was to hold, to not increase bank rate. And an important ingredient in that decision was that financial markets had given up some of their eagerness, mm-hmm. and the curve had moved to a place that I thought was appropriate for the UK economic situation. Now, going forward, just in the time since that meeting, we have meetings about every 6 weeks or so, the situation in the United States moved to markets perhaps pricing in very few cuts this year for the United States. And that may very well be appropriate for the United States. That's not my decision.
Okay.
But the markets take the U.S. situation and then interpret it into the U.K. financial metrics. And those do become relevant for my policy decision.
Right.
So this is how global capital flows can be driven by differences in economic activity, in differences in inflation prospects, and differences in policy choices by central banks. And all that collectively affects my decision-making as well.
Hmm. So if I may, just bring it back to capital flows and UK specifically. You know, you've expressed concerns in the past that the UK's investment flows currently depend on a very small number of large companies. So what's behind that? And does Brexit play into that? Like, has it changed since Brexit or not?
So you're referencing a piece of work that I've done for the National Institute for Economic Social Research and the Productivity Institute as a framework for trying to understand the forces both promoting or hindering mm-hmm. business investment in the UK.
Right.
And the focus of that framework is to understand sort of the way economists think about business investment, with sales being, you know, sales being relevant, as well as the cost of capital, net present value of investments being net present value positive, then if they're undertaken. That's one part of the framework, but there's also managers who can make decisions actually at the firm level. Mm-hmm. It's not sort of esoteric theory. It's actually, you know, are we going to take this investment or not? And they often will use a hurdle rate as opposed to something that can be calculated using the policy rate at the central bank. And then a third element of that framework is understanding the financiers of a business investment. So the concentration that you're talking about was actually based on firm-level data and investment company-level data, both of which come from the OECD.
Mm-hmm.
And the observation that comes from the OECD is that 50% of UK business investment comes from 0.5% of the firms. Okay. So it is the large multinational firms are a very important ingredient in the business investment environment in the UK. But it is there's a second type of concentration, which is that financial firms, like a big mutual fund, for example, can own a large share of the stock in a company. And if they own the large share of the stock in, say, two companies, then that becomes a very concentrated financial ownership.
Yeah.
So there are two different kinds of concentration where, in both cases, the UK does stand out in terms of the degree of concentration. Where does that come from? Well, it's two possibilities. And these concentrations have been in place for a while. So it's not explicitly like, coming from a Brexit story.
Okay. So pre-Brexit.
It's pre-Brexit. And if I think about the origins of concentrated large multinational firms being located in the UK, a lot of that comes from the UK being a market with a good rule of law, close to other markets in the European market. It has had strong innovation, English, right? These are reasons why multinationals like to be located in the UK. So that all makes sense. There have been some weakening of some of those foundations coming from Brexit, and that is a concern about how to rebuild the UK as an important anchor place or a central place for supply chains, and that's a concern.
So, but how does it compare to other like bigger economies in Europe?
It's more concentrated.
Okay.
Right. And again, why concentrated on the financial side? Well, the UK has a much deeper and more active financial market than other economies, especially the European economies. And so again, attractive place for those financial firms to be located to do their business.
And of course, your work is not only with the Bank of England. You're a distinguished professor and have held positions in several global institutions, including the OECD. So how do you see capital flows fitting into the global economy these days?
So my thoughts that I gave at the end of the session was that I am concerned that there is not just fragmentation and blockingness, which is creating blocks, which are evident in both trade and finance.
Right,
that is certainly true, and there are costs to those blocks. It's expensive. Their transactions cost. You don't get your full diversification of either products, financial products or trade products. Mm-hmm. But I actually believe that the situation is worse than that in using the term global disengagement.
Right.
And global disengagement is worse because it means not only are there blocks, but that countries within the blocks want to have more activity happening within their country. And that shows up in using industrial policy to promote domestic champions and to not be as willing to trade with your neighbors. You know, there are a range of reasons why you could use an industrial policy to deal with some market imperfections. And we all know that globalization, the gains, which frankly have been stupendous, but they have not been shared. Domestic
equally.
Inequality has been associated with globalization, and there are definitely some winners and losers. Domestic policy did not address those issues. So the question is, does industrial policy address those issues? In principle, industrial policy could do that. It could deal with market imperfections that, for example, credit doesn't get extended to the small and medium-sized enterprises, or it could deal with the issue of R&D is not necessarily being undertaken by individual firms because they don't get to retain all the gains.
Right.
So the R&D can be financed by the government. Or industrial policy could be used in a place-based situation where different parts of an economy have not done as well. And so looking as a way to jumpstart at the place-based growth and economic activity within a region. So in principle, there are industrial policies that can be used to achieve those objectives, which is to improve market imperfections. Mm-hmm. However, the new industrial policy, there's a database that comes out of St. Gallen, has been developed in conjunction with the IMF. And as it identifies across countries very, very detailed industrial policies. And if we look at the tools that are being deployed versus the tools that would close market imperfections, the tools that in fact are being deployed support incumbent large companies, national champions, or hopefully national champions. They tend to be industrial subsidies, especially in the advanced economies, that are fairly expensive from a fiscal policy perspective and do not serve this purpose of trying to solve these market imperfections. So in principle, industrial policy could be a way of redistributing gains, but that doesn't look like the way they're being deployed at all.
And do you think it might be actually feeding into this whole problem of fragmentation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Countries, policymakers have unfortunately viewed this approach of, you know, trying to protect the domestic economy. And even if that perhaps reduces the size of the pie, somehow they believe that that's the better approach to take.
Right.
And I think that if we have a whole set of policymakers and policies that are designed to protect domestic economies, then what you're giving up is pretty substantial in terms of the gains from global engagement. And smaller pies are not easier to redistribute.
So this leads into my next question, which is how you see the current state of international trade affecting capital flows.
Right. So capital flows, there are two kind of rationale for capital flows. There's capital flows that is associated with trade, and then there's capital flows that's associated with wealth. And so, you know, you could have wealth money moving around for quite a long time until you erode all of that, you know, all the wealth. But to the extent that you restrict trade, the rationale for trade-related finance, for example, becomes less important, right?
Which is a problem.
Which is a problem. Because then you only have capital flows that are associated with financial market decision-making. And that is different than capital flows associated with, for example, foreign direct investment in order to support economic activity or financial flows associated with trade activity.
And finally, international financial institutions, like the one you're sitting in right now, what is their role, do you think, in trying to regulate or manage in any way capital flows? Or should they have any part in it at all, do you think?
So the new institutional view, I guess it's just called the institutional view now. It was new when I was at the OECD. That was where there was a significant rethink of the role for different kinds of capital flow management measures.
Right.
And the original authorship of the new institutional view made it very clear that capital flow management measures were the last thing, not the first thing, that macroeconomic policy framework, independent central bank, fiscal discipline, macroprudential on financial environment. I would add, of course, coming from the OECD, structural policies, that these are the fundamentals that support economic growth and higher living standards in countries, and that only at the end of the, as a last resort to deal with capital flow volatility, would implementation of capital flow management measures be appropriate. But I think in practice, a lot of capital flow management measures are implemented as insurance policies and to avoid any possible source of financial instability. And there are costs to having those measures in place. I think they're not free from the standpoint of potentially restricting capital flows more than would be appropriate. If you buy too much insurance, it's just as bad as if you buy too little.
Catherine Mann is a professor of the practice at Brandeis University, as well as an external member of the Monetary Policy Committee at the Bank of England. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You can watch a webcast of the panel discussion on capital flows during the IMF World Bank Spring Meetings at imf.org. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.